Welcome to Wilderness Tracks, in which artists, scientists, writers, and thinkers tell me about six pieces of music that connect them to the natural world. In September, I travel to Suffolk to meet the author of, among other things, three brilliant novels and a new collection of nature diaries, The Stubborn Light of Things, which shares its name with her beautiful and wildly popular podcast.
My name's Melissa Harrison, and I'm a novelist and nature writer who lives in rural Suffolk. It's almost like I've said that before.
I was hoping for, hi, how are you doing?
I reserve that, that's reserved. I might get it on a t-shirt though.
Right, shall we wander?
Let's, we're going left. This village, I can do a different walk every day for about 2 weeks. I can vary it every day. It's great.
And you do walk every day. I know that from listening to the podcast.
I do. I didn't walk on Monday, and it really affects my mood. And even when I'm really busy, I need to make sure that I do actually get out, because otherwise I can feel it later in the day, and then I can feel it the next day, and everything starts to go a bit wrong. So there was a period a few weeks ago where I was trying to finish a book, and I was on a deadline. I was writing every day, and I had the podcast to make. So I was going out to do the podcast, but that's work. So I don't get the same feeling about the landscape and the same feeling about my walk as I do when it's just me or just me and the dog. So even my walks weren't giving me what I needed, and things got a bit dark. But then I handed in the book, and then I was able to go out and enjoy myself and just go out for the pleasure of it, and it was all right again. I think we need to get out of the way of the library then. He comes once a month and brings our books, and he's a lovely chap, ex-policeman, full of stories, great gossip.
Yeah, I mean, he's crying out to be the character in a novel, I would think. An ex-policeman.
Library van man, yeah, yeah, maybe.
You know, if you were after a killer and you couldn't work out why this person turned up in these odd locations,
and then they
seemingly disconnected.
To the local library van route, yeah.
Anyway, so the podcast, The Stubborn Light of Things, seems to have really found its place beautifully.
Thank you. Yeah, I could say that was a surprise, but for the first time actually in my life, at the beginning of a project, I felt like I knew that this was something people needed. I really had a strong, almost evangelical sense that people were going to miss spring and summer. And I was living in this place where I could just walk out and it was all around me, and that I could offer that to people. And so I did sort of know that people wanted it. You know, I've got a niece who is high risk, and she was shielding in a one-bedroom flat in London with no outside space at all. And, you know, that was going on all over the country. And yet I had all of this space. And so that didn't seem fair. It was a way also that I could carry on enjoying being here, because I was taking that privilege and trying to make it available to other people.
And how has it changed your relationship with the place? Do you see this place and hear this place, this beautiful Suffolk countryside, with a car going past? Do you see it and hear it differently as a result of kind of refracting it through the podcast, or the making of the podcast?
Yeah, totally. I mean, for years now, I've been quite connected to the seasons and to birdsong and to how the year feels and works. But this just changed it completely. And listening to what it sounded like, listening to all the new birds that arrived, and then listening to them depart as well, and, you know, hearing the fields and the hedges grow quieter, I really focused in on that in a way that, you know, I thought I already was, but clearly I wasn't, because it got a lot more intense. Me and my producer Peter, we just threw ourselves into it. We got the first episode out within, I think, 8 or 9 days of me receiving the field recorder in the post, and we were just, you know, making it up. This is lovely acorns.
Lovely acorn sound.
Underfoot. But I don't have any training, and I don't really know how to. I don't know how else I could do it. I, I'm I'm very sort of unschooled in all of it, so I'm just making it up.
I find it a very generous place. I feel like it's a place, and it's strange to be walking in the, within that space
we
now.
We are in that place.
Yes. And it's very, you know, I feel like it's a very generous open space with lots of room in it, and room for the natural sounds, but also the music, which brings us to your first piece of music, which is by your producer.
It is, Peter Rogers. It's a track called The Owl Balm that he made for the podcast, and we had no intention at the beginning of actually making full tracks or him releasing them. He was just making little incidental bits. And yeah, Peter's an amazing musician. He's an electronic musician, and he's half of a drum and bass duo called Technomatic. But his real love is, or one of his real loves is ambient music.
Yep.
But he's not really had an outlet to release it much before. So he was making these little bits, and people were really responding to them and saying, you know, are you going to release this stuff? And I was saying, you should, come on, do it. And so he expanded them into full-length tracks and put out an album.
Have you chosen it because you need to keep on his good side, because as a piece of music, and it does fit very well with some of the other pieces that you've chosen. I'm just curious, had you heard that and had no connection with it, would you have immediately thought, wow, that's amazing? Because it is, I think it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I listen to a lot of ambient as well. I'm from a dance music background, but I'm 45, so my tastes have matured. I'm still listening to music that's made electronically, but a lot of it is things like Nils Fram and people like that now. You know, I'm turning into an adult who goes to see these musicians at the Barbican sitting down rather than someone that goes to a rave anymore, which is really sad and quite hard.
I don't think it's sad. I think it's just...
Well, it's a kind of... You have to let go in the end, don't you? You have to let go of your membership of certain groups, because those groups want to exist unsullied by adults. That's where part of the identity and the subculture comes from. And at some point you have to realise that you are that adult.
Yes.
And, yeah, you know, it's not sad, but it's a kind of... Oh, there's a little sort of clench in letting go of that and going, oh, okay, I'm coming out the other side of that now.
But what I mean by saying it's not so bad is that I'm kind of turning it around and thinking, well, how wonderful it is that there's such a rich group of musicians who perhaps come from the same background who are producing that kind of music now.
Yeah.
And it's finding space on Radio 3 and all those kind of places.
Yeah,
and
fantastic. It's a sort of cohort that have come through electronic music from its early days together and are now maturing together, and that's really rich and productive and interesting, and Peter's part of that. And that track and the rest of the album to me is something I would listen to anyway, and something that, you know, very much in keeping with a lot of the music that I have in my collection.
The title of the track is The
Owl
Barn.
Barn, yeah. Yeah. It was for the episode where I saw the owl.
Which was amazing.
I was so pleased with that. When I came back with the recordings, because I'd been out a few times trying to see an owl, and I hadn't seen one, and I'd been sending him these messages saying, you know, still haven't found one. And that was the last time I was going to go out and try and get it. And I got back and I just went, oh, I've put the recordings in the folder. And I didn't tell him that I had. And I made him sit and listen, waited until he got to the end of the recording where there was
one. Because you'd pretty much given up as well.
Yeah.
In the recordings, you'd given up and you were pretty much trudging home.
We were running
home.
Out of time,
yeah.
And the whole thing was kind of not going well. So yeah, I didn't tell him. And then I was watching his WhatsApp messages as he was listening to it. And then watched him get to the point where he realised that I had. We were really pleased with that episode. Oh my god, it just flew right past me! And here it is again. It's going back the way it came. Oh my god, it looked right at me! It's going back down the hedge line to where I was before. Off it goes. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh, it's so beautiful.
Here we go, where we're going, Village Green. Little sign pointed towards. In the podcast, I was very struck by a different episode as well. There was a moment where you were talking about how pronounced your desire to fit in and be accepted was as a younger person, certainly. And I was thinking about your character Linda in your first novel, Clay?
Yeah.
Who feels that very keenly as well. Is that something that you felt quite strongly with music, or was music somewhere where you just knew what you liked and what you wanted from the off?
It's somewhere between the two, I think. I had that feeling of I have to get my identity right and it has to be acceptable and it needs to be read correctly. It needs to be passed by other people in a way that gives me value, because I didn't think I had any intrinsic value. But music, I sought out subcultures quite young, from about 14 or 15, because the dominant culture at my comprehensive was sort of pop music and Campri ski jackets, perms and pixie boots. And we didn't have the money to do any of that. My clothes were mostly hand-me-downs, and that crowd were never going to accept me. So I fell into subcultures as a way of finding something that they couldn't judge because it was separate. I wasn't trying to be like them and failing and not having the right puffable skirt or whatever.
Yeah.
I was doing something else. So I was still trying to get approval, but just not from the main crowd.
And where was this?
Surrey. So I was a sort of indie kid, I suppose, at 15, 16. And then really discovered dance music when I went to university. And
that was Oxford, was it?
That was Oxford, yeah. I was a comprehensive kid who went to Oxford and made friends with mainly kids who I felt I had things in common with.
Yeah.
And one of the things we used to do was to get on the Oxford Tube, which was a bus that ran to London, and go to clubs all night and then get it back in the morning. And so we went to places like Club UK in Wandsworth in its very early days, when it was all sort of psytrance and goa trance and DJs wearing Viking helmets. And it was great. It was a way of, you know, saying I don't go to boat club cocktails and I don't have a designer frock, but I do this other thing and it's cooler than you, so.
At what point did you start to discover a sense that you did have some innate, you know, worth? Did it come partly through that identification with that subculture?
Probably quite recently, really. It's always been a bit shaky. I think if you're not given it consistently as a child, it's quite hard to pick up as an adult. So it's been up and down, really. But the last maybe 10 years, I felt I'm okay, actually. I'm doing all right.
When did Clay come out?
Well, Clay was part of the process of thinking about my childhood and processing it. I didn't realise. I wrote a main character who I thought was very different from me. He was a boy. He was mixed race. He was an only child. I'm one of six. And he was urban, whereas I was firmly suburban.
This is TC.
TC, yeah. And then I was giving my first public reading at Big Green Books in North London, it was then. And as I was giving the reading, I suddenly realised that he was me. And it was quite a difficult moment, really. It sort of rushed in on me that actually I'd written a very lonely child who was finding solace in the natural world and who was constantly frightened.
Shall we move on to your second piece of music?
Yes.
Which is?
It's Red Kite by a band called Grasscut, who are Andrew Phillips and Marcus O'Dare, and they're on a label called Ninja Tune, which is really well respected in the dance music community. And they're part of this wave of people who are more my age and a bit older, who are making really intelligent electronic music. And they're really plugged into the idea of landscape. I think with their first two albums, they did something where there were clues in the albums and then you could go to a location and find a cassette or something. And I love that. It reminded me of the Masquerade book.
Yes, the bit with the hair.
The golden hair that was buried in the countryside, which I was obsessed with as a child.
Yes, absolutely.
And that kind of crossover between something, a piece of art, a book or an album, and a real object in the world, I just thought that was really interesting. I've seen them live back when such things were possible.
And why this particular track?
Oh, God. Well, I could have picked anything from the album. It's called Everyone Was a Bird, which is a line from a Siegfried Sassoon poem about the end of the war. And this is the track from the album that contains that line. And the Sassoon poem says something like, everyone was a bird, but the singing was wordless, and the singing will never be done, or something like that. But in the Grasscut version, they say that it's sung with words, and it's about pylons and straw bales and this collision of the bucolic with the industrial that I find really interesting. They're not about the pretty countryside, they're about what's really out there and how it feels and how compromised it is. I think it's beautiful.
There's a red kite flying above the pines. There's a black crow sat on the phone line. Skylarks fly, describe the sky. And we two follow the hillside. Through the stone piles up to the...
I find it stunningly beautiful. I'd never come across it before, and I watched the video, which really brings that juxtaposition forward with the pylons and so on.
There's another track on the album called Curlews, which has got a lovely video as well, and the sound of curlews in the background.
And it's an unexpected take, I guess, for somebody coming for the first time to art that's dealing with the landscape. What was that?
Robin. And there's a distant chiff-chaff somewhere. Yeah, late chiff-chaff. They'll be off soon.
But yes, for somebody who's kind of approaching art of any kind, that's dealing with the English pastoral, I suppose, right now, they might be surprised at that juxtaposition. And just looking around us now, just stop. I can't see any pylons, I confess. And, you know, you're in absolutely the kind of crosshairs of the image of English pastoralism that I kind of carry around with
me. This is why I wanted to do this walk, because this track in particular, down to this farm, you can imagine it being completely unchanged for 60-70 years. You know, it's a little corner of old Suffolk, and there's something very alluring but very dangerous about this idea of our bucolic shared past.
An ominous wind has just kind of passed by. Yes. Because it's so alluring, isn't it?
Yeah, and what we're nostalgic for, if we're really honest about it, is an idea of an England before the Windrush. Before, you know, it's white, it's wealthy, it's Anglican, it's southeastern. This idea of rolling hills and vales and a little village with a sign outside the pub and a, you know, pump on the green excludes so much. Even, you know, excludes a lot of England even in the 1930s. You know, where's the pit villages? That's, you know, none of that is caught up in that image. And yet that image is the one that, you know, sent men to die in two world wars to protect. So seeing what's really there is something I try to do in All Among the Barley. I conjured up this, what we're seeing now, this farm and these, you know, haystacks, and then tried to blow it apart. And it's something that I tried to do in at Hawthorne Time as well. You know, there's an artist in that book called Kitty who keeps trying to paint pretty landscapes and they don't come to anything. And it's when she starts to notice the dog shit and the litter and the
plastic bags and the,
yeah,
the fences,
what's really there, that she finds she has something to say. And that's kind of what writing was to me. For a long time I wanted to be a writer. I didn't want to write any books. And so I couldn't. And it was when I realised I had something to say that I became a writer.
You clearly are brilliant at interrogating that. But again, that's a novel that finishes in a very unresolved fashion. literally unresolved. We don't know who the...
Well, the clues are all there, actually.
Are they?
Yes.
Oh, right,
so
okay.
It opens and closes with a car crash. And if you want to work out who dies and who survives, it is all there.
I don't need to fill the name. One of my daughters is an Agatha Christie nut, so I'll get her to read it and see if she can do it for me. But I guess what I'm curious about is, in the most recent book, All Among the Barley, you've got the character who comes in from the sophisticated urbane world.
Yeah, Constance Fitzalan, who arrives from London wearing men's trousers.
Yes, and you think, oh, here's a likely heroine, but then turns out to be, well, I won't spoil it, but deeply problematic.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, going back to Clay, was this real sense of how special nature was to those people in an urban setting who were attuned to it. Because in part of its scarcity.
Yeah.
And here you've got this kind of abundance, almost a surfeit of nature. And I'm wondering whether you sometimes struggle to have those special moments of encounter that you talk about.
No.
Okay, fair enough. I'll stop there.
No, it's not that different to me. I mean, obviously, they're completely different landscapes, but the feeling I can get from a place or from the fact of something living there and the way those creatures can be interconnected and interdependent is the same here as it is in London. And part of what drove me wanting to write Clay was to give other people the same feeling of connection to what is there, which is a lot, actually. But you have to retune your eyes from expecting what's around us now, you know, this is what we think of as nature, to something else. And it might be the fact that your postbox has got six kinds of lichen on it. And that's amazing. It's not a reduced, it's not poverty. It's that's an amazing richness. And, you know, you start to see which animals can cope with us being all around them. And start to forgive them for their encroachment. People get very angry with anything that encroaches on our space, whether it's foxes or rats or whatever it is, or pigeons. You know, the moment there's lots of them and they live near us, we hate them. But these are the brave, adaptable, clever creatures.
I know. Well, we've got a small walled garden in the town centre and we get rats occasionally. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to pretend to love the pluck of the little fellas. When it's a walled garden, it feels like they're staring at you, you're staring at them.
They'll be tunnelling underneath the...
Don't say that.
But, you know, they're a mammal. They're wildlife. But I'm not exempt from this. I've got a thing about wood pigeons. I really hate them.
You can't hate a wood pigeon.
I do, and I'm trying not to. I'm really working on myself, but I do recognise the impulse to put something in that category. You know, I had a man a while ago tell me starlings were second only to Al-Qaeda. He was so angry. And, you know, it's easy to laugh at, but I'm so cross with wood pigeons. They're sort of quite lacking in personality as well, you know, to look at. But they're cool.
Come on, you're the queen of bird call. They've got a fantastic...
They have, I know. And I never minded them until I moved to this village, which in spring is surrounded by oilseed rape fields. And they're a major pest of oilseed rape. And you see them decimating the crops. And because of that, they put gas guns on the fields. And the gas guns go off three times every half an hour. And it means that when my dog Scout comes to stay, she's completely petrified and shaking.
You're making a leap here. It's just, you're painting it as if the wood pigeons have got the gas guns in their hands, in their wings.
No, the farmers put the gas guns on the fields. And so you start to feel this sense of sort of besiegement almost in the village. And it's very hard not to pick up on that. And I suppose it's the same with rats and foxes.
Anyway, moving on to the third piece, which is by Sam Lee.
Oh, Sam, he's an amazing, incredible man, isn't he? He's a folk singer, he's a song collector, he's an environmentalist, he runs events, he writes, he's, you know, jack of all trades, really. Really interesting man. And
still very young, for all those things that he's done.
Yeah, he's done a lot. He's been around the block, as Sam.
Gets on your nerves a bit, surely.
He's got the most beautiful, rich baritone that I think I've ever heard. I mean, his voice is just astonishing. And this track, Soul Cake, which is from his recent album, Old Wow, the beginning of it is a version of Green Grow the Rushes O.
Yeah.
Which is in itself a fascinating old folk song because nobody knows what it means. It's not a round, but it's a song where it builds. So you add a new line with each verse and you have to remember the lines that you've added and sing it. And half the lines, nobody knows what they mean. They're so old and they appear in... There's a Jewish version that is very similar. Some of the lines are different. Nobody really knows. There's some biblical references in there. There's astronomical references. It's just fascinating how it survived and how it has probably altered over the years so that we don't know what to make of it anymore. But it's... Green Grow the Rushes, though, is one of the songs we used to sing in the car when I was a kid.
Oh, fantastic.
One of our car songs. We were a family of six of us, and we used to, six kids, and Mum would be chain smoking, the car would be full of smoke.
Yeah, I remember this. I wasn't in your car, but my mum did the same.
And we'd sing. We were quite a singing family. We always sung in a way that I'm not sure that many families do anymore, which is a shame.
Ours do constantly.
Really?
Oh, all the time.
Oh, good.
All the time. Never stops.
There should be more of that, I think. The unselfconscious pleasure of singing. And, you know, I can hold a tune, but I don't have a voice that's in any way interesting. But I loved it when I was a kid. And I liked singing in church. We used to go to church. And I used to... the Christmas carols... Oh, God, this makes me blush. Christmas carol service, I would belt out the descant to O Come All Ye Faithful by myself in the pew, you know. And nobody ever said anything. And probably everyone was deeply irritated with this sort of 10-year-old girl doing that. But that's... I just enjoyed it, so I did it.
So, I don't think there's a greater pleasure in life, is there, than just putting your head back and belting out
a
song?
Yeah, exactly. And we used to have our little carol services at home round the piano, because lots of us would play the piano, so we'd take turns. And we had a little crib, and it was a thing that we did with candles. And we used to sing in the car on these endless trips to Devon that took several years in my recollection. And we had a whole pantheon of car songs. And Green Grow the Rushes was one of them. And I hadn't heard it in years. And then I bought Sam's album. And the moment that track came on, I just got chills.
I'll sing you one, oh. Green grow the rushes, oh. What is your one, oh? One is one and all alone. And evermore shall be so. I'll sing you to woe. Green grow the rushes, oh.
Another thing about that song, it's, I didn't know this, but it's actually rooted in a folk custom and tradition built around Halloween, the soul cake. It came from Cheshire, which is now where I live, and people would make these very humble cakes and they'd take them round to neighbours, I think. I love those kind of little stories of ritual and so on.
Yeah, lots of those, aren't there, from different parts of the world, and often quite subtly different. Lots of things involving cakes and biscuits as well, and neighbours, and I guess that's, you know, that was a currency.
Yeah.
You baked and you cooked and you shared.
Do you know Nutcrack Night?
No.
Nutcrack Night is my favourite, I think. It was a kind of version of Halloween way back when in the north of England and Scotland. So Robbie Burns has written about it. But I can't quite remember the detail of it. But basically, if you would put two nuts, I'm not sure what kind of nut, into the fire, into a campfire on All Hallows Eve. And if the other one split, then your beloved was unfaithful, I think.
Ooh.
If it burned very well, then he was the one for you, or she was the one for you.
It's a prognostication ritual.
Yes, and listeners can correct this, but if they both burned well together, then you were going to be wed.
Oh, that's nice.
Lovely.
That's like, there's lots of those, aren't there? There's lots of things you could do at dawn or with the dew to find out your future partner. And there was something about... at New Year, somebody with red hair had to be the first person that came into your house.
Yes,
and all sorts of just amazing. If you read Alison Utley, you find a lot of these little rituals preserved. So yeah, that's where Soulcake. I kind of vaguely knew that, but I wasn't sure. So that's thank you.
My detail is incredibly sketchy and is based on a kind of half-hour Google search yesterday.
Well, I'm going to do a Google search when we get back.
Well, just ring Sam Lee. I'm sure he'll be able to tell you. Or maybe he doesn't. Maybe he just kind of pulled it from the air.
No, he's quite plugged into all of this stuff, you know. And he also, we should mention his Nightingale Nights.
Of course,
he's been
yes.
doing going out and singing and playing with nightingales. And you know, he's really, the work that he's done to raise awareness of the plight of nightingales is astonishing. And he's combined that with performing and doing something he loves. And I think that's one of the ways in which when advocacy is really effective is when it comes from love and when it comes from your real core skills. You know, we can all sign petitions and, you know, write cross letters to our MPs. I think when people are speaking and acting out of their heart and using the thing that they're here for, I think it can make a real difference, and that's what Sam does.
And attracting people to the glow of it, because it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's coming to Timber Festival next year, in
Is
fact,
he?
For listeners who want to buy tickets.
Well, I'd highly recommend it. He's a really interesting man.
That ritual thing I find fascinating. And in terms of the kind of turn of the seasons that you've already talked about here, you've got these kind of two combating versions of ways to see the world, and, you know, the cyclical built around seasons and turning and so on and returning against the kind of straight arrow of time
and change.
And change.
Yeah.
How does that bear down on you, if at all?
Oh, well, it all bears down on me, as it bears down on all of us. The progression of change and loss. It's really tricky because there's huge comfort to be found in the seasons and the idea of return and the idea of rebirth and the idea that they're unchanging. And of course, they're not unchanging anymore. And we sometimes over-exaggerate that. You know, I get a lot of inquiries from people saying they think X or Y seasonal event is early or late. And a lot of it is seasonal variation because, you know, if you go back and look at the records, which you could look at on the Nature's Calendar website, you can see, you know, things like hawthorn bud burst or first blackbird or last chiffchaff move around a lot. But at the same time, we know that there are really huge shifts taking place. And that some of them are happening too fast for animals to keep up with. So things like migratory birds coming here to take advantage of an insect explosion. If that insect explosion shifts and they're not able to adapt their flight patterns in time, or things like caterpillars, you know, they need to be available for birds to feed their young, because you can't feed young birds grain or adult insects. If that goes off too much, everything starts to collapse. So that's frightening, and it's really hard to think about. But at the same time, we are here now, and we have to love it. We have to love it, because without loving it, without loving what is here and what is left, we are not going to do the work, I don't think, that's necessary to make any kind of change. For me, I think change comes from love. And so, you know, this isn't to criticise writers and activists who are about showing us the worst case scenario, because we need that too. But what my work is, I feel quite strongly, is to try and do the early bit, which is to connect people to the natural world in a way that's authentic and felt and lived. Because the other stuff comes afterwards. You know, because I'm quite celebratory, it doesn't mean that I'm not aware of the trouble that we're in.
And it's, and you know, you mentioned it about Sam Lee, it's about using the thing that you have the capacity to do. And, you know, looking after your Voltairean garden.
Yeah.
Putting to use your set of skills.
Yeah. You know, one of the hardest things I think that we're all struggling with is, how much do I need to do? How much is my responsibility? Do we need to get behind every cause? You could end up not being able to live your life if you put all of the care that other people require of you into every single thing that needs fixing at the moment, because there is so much. And we've all, probably people who care about the natural world and about, you know, politics as well, had moments and days where we just feel exhausted and hopeless.
That dog doesn't look either hopeless or exhausted.
He's just got a lot to say for himself. Hello. So he's going to now feel all pleased because he's seen us off the property.
I think he was asking for your next piece of music, actually.
Oh, was he? Was that what that was about?
I think so. I just kind of picked that up. I thought you were the person who could read nature. So we're on to the Lark Ascending.
Oh, well, God, you know, I felt this is too obvious and I shouldn't pick it, because I'm sure lots of people pick this when they think about music connected to landscape. I mean, I didn't grow up with any connection to classical music at all. My dad was a jazz buff, so we listened to a lot of jazz in the house. My mum wasn't really that interested in music. And my siblings, who are all older, were, you know, Debbie Harry, David Bowie.
Debbie Harry was your sister.
I wish.
Yeah.
But that's what the house was filled with.
Yes.
So I didn't grow up with any kind of context or anything for classical music.
No, me neither. So when you discover it, it's all fair game, isn't
it? Yeah, and I think I came to it really from the electronic music angle when I started to listen to neoclassical, and, you know, lots of people that were using strings and full orchestras, and I think that was my way in. And I've been to see a couple of things. I went to a Rachmaninoff concert and I clapped at the wrong place. Yes, I wasn't the only one, but, you know, so, you know, I'm that embarrassing person who doesn't know anything, and that's fine. The Lark Ascending obviously is breathtaking and beautiful, but this particular performance I saw live at the Albert Hall, and it's a violinist called Ty Murray, and I was there because I recorded a prom interval talk
for Radio 3,
and then got a ticket to the prom, and I went and I took my friend Saskia, who'd been there lots of times before and knew how to behave and what to do and everything, which was great. And what I loved about this performance is that she is a black violinist, and this is such a piece of English pastoral that is so easily turned into something to do with nativism and, you know, a very sort of white and limited and sort of jingoistic idea of the English countryside. So I just found it, I was just in bits from the moment she started, frankly. I'd already knew the piece of music and come to love it, and when she came on and started playing, and to hear those notes feeding out into that space and the way that they echoed around and the sort of breathless feeling of it, and to see what she brought to it, I loved it. I really loved it. I think I cried.
I love the way you talk about that, because I feel a little bit like there's something similar with the countryside and an encounter with the countryside. If you don't grow up in a rural setting, or you don't grow up with classical music, and when you finally kind of get to it and open your eyes or ears to it, it's like, don't be telling me what is hackneyed or overplayed, because I don't know. I'm just seeing these beautiful fields. I grew up in the suburbs as well. I've seen these beautiful fields and they're great, so don't tell me it's too John Constable. And if I hear the Lark Ascending and realise it's absolutely extraordinary, because it is, then don't be telling me, because you grew up in a different milieu, that you should be listening to something more hidden away and niche.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose it would be easy for me to criticise using music as a way of sort of social coding like that, but you know, that's what I used to do with dance music as well. You know, I used to really like getting to know really niche artists, and I'd be slightly mocking about dance music that got into the charts. So I've been there and done that too.
Yes, yeah. Inverted snobbery.
Yeah, totally.
Love it.
But you know, it is this piece of music that absolutely captures a lark singing. It's not a transliteration, but it's an interpretation, and it's the weightlessness of it and the purity of it and the joy of it is I haven't heard anything like that.
I'm going to have to stop because we're just walking past. You're very blasé about this, but this incredible oak tree.
Isn't it beautiful?
Is this your oak tree that you climb into?
No. In my last village, I had a nearby oak that I used to climb and watch the sun go down. And when I moved to this village, the first thing I did was go and look for a climbing tree. But unfortunately, this one, although it's a huge 600, 700-year-old veteran oak, it's in someone's front garden, let's be honest. So it can't be my climbing tree. It's also on a regular dog walking route, as you can hear, and sitting up there and, you know, watching everyone pass
throwing
underneath.
Throwing acorns
not
at people.
Not quite the experience I'm after. And there's even a handy ladder on the other side, so it really, you know, it calls to me, but it's not my tree.
It's not your tree. All right, well, let's move on then. This feels like some kind of dating show.
I would like it to be my tree if it was just somewhere else.
I can't remember what we were talking about. Oh, Vaughan Williams. Yes, indeed. The other thing about the piece, famously, is that it's written just before the outbreak of World War One.
Yeah.
And there's so much literature and music that is celebrated now about that point in time. Do you kind of dwell on that particular moment with any great fascination, the pre-First World War period?
The loss of innocence, wasn't it? It was the last moment of our childhood.
Yes.
I'm more interested in the post-war period because I think after the war you start to see everything change. That's when you start to see horses replaced with tractors on the land. Because, you know, lots of horses, nearly all our horses have been requisitioned, been killed. You know, either in action or lots of them were just put down. And the war office compensated farmers with tractors, which had been invented around that period. And that was, to me, a huge shift in our relationship with the land. Because with the end of horsepower came the end of folklore and magic and superstition, really. It was the end of one belief system and the beginning of another. The tradition of horse management had gone back generations. You were born into a horse family.
Yeah.
It was almost like a cult. And then you were initiated into horse magic when you were a young boy, and it was almost all men. And there were, you know, there's this ritual with a toad's bone and fern seeds floating up river. It was really witchy stuff, you know. And then you learn to control horses, which you did by arcane means, most of which we don't know what they were now, but some of which were tiny bottles of very strong smelling herbs, so you could make a horse stop and it wouldn't budge again potentially all day. It came with the belief in nightmares. So a nightmare
was a fairy
that rid your horse all night, and you know the horse was sweaty in the morning. And the evil eye, you know, the stones with the hole, hag stones that you'd hang over the stable. And it's just a huge belief system. And then within a generation, the same men who had been born into these horse families were asked to look after tractors. It went so suddenly. You know, with tractors, being able to ride around on them, you were separate from the soil. You weren't tramping it with your horses. You know, hay meadows. So that's the beginning of the loss of our hay meadows, because you weren't keeping horses, so they didn't need to have hay to eat in the winter. So a lot of that began to be torn up. And for me, that's the period that's really interesting, is what came after the war.
And you're a great champion of farmers within the kind of nature writing community. And I've just got the voice of somebody like James Rebank saying, yeah, but it was really hard work.
Yeah, it was.
And tractors kind of made it a lot easier.
Of course, absolutely. And no one could go back and tell those farmers, or any farmers really, that they should have done things differently, because, you know, this is a tough, marginal existence with, you know, very little money to be made. You're constantly at the whim of governments. And that's partly what All Among the Barley was about, was, you know, how hard it was when a government had, you know, passed a bill to protect the price of wheat and then reneged on it. And at the same time, you were starting to get the first imports in from, you know, you're getting corned beef on ships from Argentina and wheat coming in on boats from Canada and undercutting farmers. What were they supposed to do?
But I've also got the voice of Helen MacDonald in my ear, because I remember her talking about the need to re-enchant the world, to recapture that sense of magic. Oh, look. Is it a dragonfly, a damselfly?
Damselfly. red damselfly. There's lots of big dragonflies around, but I haven't seen a damselfly for a little while.
See, I'm gasping, you're going, oh, it's a damselfly.
No, it's lovely. It's lovely, but yeah, it would be nice to see one of those massive emperor dragonflies hoving into view.
Yes, like a helicopter.
Yeah. I was tweeting a few weeks ago, I saw a dead dragonfly on the road just up here, and I crouched down to have a look, and a wasp had bitten off its head and was eating its head, and then as I was watching, took off with its head and circled me a few times, and then took it away to eat later. So that was interesting. So
wow.
When we're talking about re-enchanting the world, it also means things like that. It means wonder. It means, God, isn't that mad? Because what probably happened is the dragonfly, which is a predator, tried to eat the wasp in midair, and the wasp stung it and killed it. That's going on all around us. That's incredible. How amazing is that?
Right, next piece of music is... Oh, I was so excited when I saw this. I've not heard this record since I used to rifle through my older brother's record collection in the 1980s when he was out, because I get into trouble. And then he took it off when he went to Poly in London, and that was the end of it. So this is Virginia Astley.
This is Virginia Astley from her album From Gardens Where We Feel Secure, which came out in 1983. So your brother was... Oh, look at that rabbit digging. Sorry, rabbit. There's a massive rabbit warren here, but they've just dug a new tunnel that is partly above ground, and you can see all the spoils. I always do check in rabbit diggings just in case, because I know people who've found arrowheads, because they're chucking up soil from underground. No arrowheads. That'd be amazing, wouldn't it? That'd be good material
that would,
for the
that would
podcast.
Be good. Let's pretend. Oh, look at that arrowhead. Look at that. I reckon that's 18th century, that.
Anyway, what we say, Virginia Astley. So yeah, she was quite a rare groove back then. Cult figure. So your brother was plugged in.
Oh yeah, he was.
Find her.
It was very cool, but it was also very beautiful. And this is a thunderous cliche, but it was so ahead of its time. This is what everyone's doing now, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's a mixture of field recordings and sound effects, and I think a lot of it was improvised, wasn't it? So very sort of odd ambient soundscapes that describe the course of an English summer's day. And they've got sounds on like a squeaky gate, which I particularly love because there's a squeaky gate in my podcast. But yeah, it's really odd and unusual and very, very beautiful, very atmospheric. And it's divided into, it's morning and afternoon, isn't it, the two sections. I think it's 9 tracks. And she became quite popular in Japan, I think, and went over there and did some recording. Now she's been... You know, there's this upsurge of interest in her, and I think it's been re-released. She was on Rough Trade, originally another amazing label.
And she writes now as well.
She does. She's become a poet, and she published a collection of poems about the Thames called The English River. She's just a really interesting woman, and this track, this whole album, is beautiful and strange and haunting and not like anything else I've heard, really.
Where would you listen to it, and how would you listen to it? Would you listen to it on a walk? Would you listen to it while you're writing?
I don't listen to music when I'm walking at all. I like to hear what's going on around me. I would lie in the sun on a blanket with headphones on and listen to it.
Do you listen to music when you write at all, or do you have to concentrate?
Yeah, rarely. Even music without lyrics, unless it's completely beatless, I can't write with it on, because I need to hear the rhythm of my sentences. I know that sounds really pretentious, but my sentences do have a rhythm that is really important, and the stresses need to fall in the right places, and I can't hear that if it's overridden by a beat. So no, most of the time not.
You were talking earlier about anxieties about fitting in, and that only recently coming into your life. Is it fully there now? Are you in a garden where you feel entirely secure now?
No, because becoming more visible publicly changes everything again. It's another new thing to get used to. It's a weird balance to go from somebody who at school would have loved the idea that people want to spend time with me to suddenly finding myself in that position where, you know, there is a tension there if I want it. I actually find it really uncomfortable. And this is just, very, very much at the beginning of this journey. But I can see how attention can go to people's heads. I can see how people can become easily quite monstrous, because you can spend time with people who just will agree with you all the time and tell you you're wonderful. And if you're somebody that doesn't know that themselves, that can be really overbalancing. And that can quite damage, that can be quite warping, actually. This is hard to talk about because it makes it sound as though I'm saying I'm famous, and I'm not. It's just that I'm putting stuff out into the world and people are liking it. And that means that they feel that they know me and like me. And that's unearned because they don't know me. They pre-like you, they pre-approve of you because they've read your books.
Or otherwise, they'd pretty dislike you.
Yes, yeah, and that's equally overbalancing. So I was feeling like I had worked it out, and now it's changing again, and I need to be careful and feel my way into this new period in my life and not turn into a fucking monster. Sorry for swearing.
It's all right. But I'm kind of interested from you saying that and standing here in this beautiful bit of the country, which was an engagement, as I understand it. You know, you were engaging with this part of the world. Are you kind of conscious that it remains an engagement and not a retreat to some extent?
Well, when I moved here, the plan was to spend time in London. So I was still working at Mixed Mag. So I was spending 2 weeks a month in London, Monday to Friday, and then coming back at weekends. And that was great because, you know, most of my friends are still in London, and I was able to keep up with the part of me that has loved dance music for so long and feel sort of plugged into all sorts of the ways in which I constituted my identity. And then retreat, as you say, here to somewhere where I don't know that many people and I live a very solitary life. And then, of course, coronavirus has upended all of that. So I had 4 months in a village where I didn't really know anyone because I only bought the house a year ago yesterday. And that was actually very hard, and I did feel like I'd retreated, and I did feel really lonely and really, really cut off. And I know, you know, London isn't the be-all and end-all. It's not about London's the best place. It's just where my friends happen to be. And social media is great up to a point, but it's the source of both connection and all sorts of other difficult things as well. So if that becomes the only place where you get company, it means you're also opening up yourself to all the bad things of social media as well. So that period was quite tough, and I'm quite scared that we're going to lock down again.
The irony is that at that point, obviously you're communicating with your books in the past, but at that very moment through lockdown, you're communicating in a perhaps a more direct and personal way with your voice reaching out to all those thousands of people with the podcast.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And the podcast is it's another layer of intimacy with people, because my voice is going directly into their ears, and that's what I wanted, and that's what I needed to offer and can offer, and I'm glad to have offered. But it adds to the feeling people have that we're friends. And that's a lovely thing, and I'm not complaining about it, but it just makes new friendships quite difficult sometimes, because there's an imbalance. People know a lot about me, and I don't necessarily know anything about them. So as life goes on, I'm learning new ways to meet people and become friends with them that aren't solely related to me being a writer. I need to not be writer Mel all the time. I need to be all the other parts of me and still have those other parts validated and reflected back and be able to be expressed.
Right, we've got between now and the cafe just ahead to fit in your last song, which is Thom Yorke.
It is Thom Yorke. God, I mean, he's a genius, isn't it? Isn't he? We can all agree. He's an astonishing... astonishing musician and creator and just human being, really. I loved Radiohead from all the way back to Pablo Honey when I was a teenager and just thought they were amazing. And then there was a period where they got a bit too hard for me and I felt that they had become the possession of boys.
Yes.
But recently I've been rediscovering them, and this track, Dawn Chorus, I love the fact that you expect a track about the Dawn Chorus,
yes,
to be bucolic and beautiful and hopeful, and it isn't.
It's a crackle, isn't there? There's a kind of...
it's dark. It's beautiful. It is beautiful, but it's dark and claustrophobic. And it feels to me, I used to go to clubs a lot, and it feels to me like when you've been out all night and you haven't slept and you're a bit all over the place for all sorts of reasons, and the light is starting to come up and everything's a bit awful and you're bleary and your attention is starting to move away from the night you've just had to the day that you're about to have to endure. But at the same time, you know, the dawn is rising and it is beautiful, but it's troubling and difficult for you as well. And that's, I know that's a really particular sort of little scene that I've just created in my head to go with this song, but it is a really complex piece of music, and it's also a really daring piece of music. Like, how do you think that up? How do you make that noise that didn't exist before? How do you just go, oh, I'm going to write that? Like, where does that come from?
That is the question I continually ask when I hear a piece of music, a spellbinding piece of music. It's exactly that question. Okay, you have an idea, but how does a musical idea form? And how do you then turn it into that noise?
Well, I used to think this about books, and I think one of the reasons I didn't write for so long was that I thought you had to have an idea for a book. I would read other people's books and go, how did you have that idea? And it turns out some people do have ideas for books, and you know, they sit down, have the idea, and then they plan the book out and write it. But it turns out that that doesn't work for me, and that's all right. And I didn't hear anyone around me talking about this other way of writing books, which was more of a sort of collage, that you could just write your way into white space and not know what the book was, not know what was going to happen or anything, and that your brain would eventually put things together, and you know, you'd end up with all sorts of kind of psychic objects on the table in front of you, like, you know, I really like old farms and I really like folklore and I really like, I've got this idea for a scene and I would like it to have a fox in it or whatever, and your brain will put those things together and make a plot out of it. I didn't know that, and maybe this is how Thom Yorke can make music like this. He's not sitting down and going, I've got an idea for a song about the Dawn Chorus. He's just making some sounds, and this is where it led him.
Please let me know when you've had enough of the white light.
There's a feeling at the start of a novel, before you've actually really started writing it, before you've messed it up, it feels like this really pure, shining idea, but it's just out of your focus. It's like the blind spot in your eye. You know when you try and look at something and if you look directly at it, your fovea goes over it. It's like that. There's a thing I need to make. I can't look directly at it because it will disappear. But I can move towards it. I can just keep moving towards it. And then inevitably, what happens as you move towards it is you create something actual on the page that erases that vision. And the vision disappears eventually. And that's really gutting because you haven't written the book that you wanted to. But you look back at what you have written and it's generally okay. It's like a will-o'-the-wisp. You follow it into the distance and you never get to it. It moves away from you and you create something else in the process. But that feeling of the shining thing that you want to pursue, I'm wondering if that feels like it used to feel at the beginning of a night out. And I'm feeling quite wistful thinking about that idea of feeling of getting ready and going out and not knowing what the night was going to hold. Especially as, for me, somebody that was didn't have a good time at school and was quite wary of strangers and didn't feel too good about myself, going out to clubs, those connections were really meaningful to me. Even though they were fleeting, even though you'd be gurning at each other and chatting about nothing, for me, being able to move through the world like that and feel safe with new people was transformative. And so I used to have this amazingly hopeful feeling at the beginning of the night that I was walking into something unknown and it was going to be an adventure. Maybe it's the same moving into a novel. I don't know.
Well, that's a lovely way to end. Thank you very much, Melissa. Shall we get a cup of tea?
Yeah, let's do that.
Wilderness Tracks is produced by me, Jeff Bird, as part of the Timber Festival. If you enjoyed this episode, there are more to enjoy wherever you get your podcasts. Please do like and subscribe. The series is made in association with the National Forest, where timber takes place each July.